Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
I did have a very, very dear friend die, and 3 days after her death, I don't know how to put this into words, but she woke me up. I was asleep. She woke me up. She was standing at the end of my bed, and she did not say anything. Unlike Jesus, she didn't say anything, but I do remember thinking at the time, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, and whoever is in this state would be the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It was a very encouraging, edifying few moments for me.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome along to today's show, a show involving some really interesting stories of supernatural encounters today and asking, does it make sense to believe in them? I'll introduce my guest, Dale Allison, shortly. But it's been quite the week here in the UK. As I speak, there are still queues miles and miles long in London of those queuing to pass by the Queen's coffin lying in state at Westminster Hall ahead of the state funeral on Monday. That's going to be a public holiday across the whole of the country. Thanks to all those who've been in touch from all over the world to offer condolences. And if you didn't catch it, we had some really helpful responses on last week's Unbelievable show just after the news had broken from people like N.T. Wright and Gavin Ashenden and Ruth Jackson. We followed that up with lots more articles on our website this past week reflecting on this moment, including one coming out this weekend, Glenn Scrivener, on the latent spirituality in our post-Christian country that's on display as people pay their respects in a variety of Christian settings. Churches, cathedrals have been packed out with well-wishers and mourners. Also, some great fresh podcast material. Matters of Life and Death this past week saw John and Tim Wyatt interview Mark Green, a biographer of the Queen's Christian faith. And on Monday, you can hear the latest C.S. Lewis podcast, Ruth Jackson speaking to Michael Ward about C.S. Lewis's interactions with Queen Elizabeth II, his view of the monarchy, all available as ever at our website, premierunbelievable.com. And if you subscribe to the newsletter while you're there, you'll never miss a thing. And on top of all of that, of course, we hosted our live online event on Tuesday evening, Falling from Grace. What an amazing evening. Superb contributions from our panelists on church abuse and leadership scandals. So many great questions from those who attended as well. More on that later. But for now, let's get into today's show. Great to be joined today by Dale Allison as we ask, can skeptics take religious experiences seriously? New Testament scholar Dale Allison is from Princeton Theological Seminary and well known for his work on the Gospels and the resurrection accounts, a subject we discussed earlier in the year with Justin Bass here on the show. But Dale returns solo today to talk to me about his new book, Encountering Mystery, Religious Experience in a Secular Age. Dale's research has found that a surprising number of people, both historically and today, report experiences. It could be inexplicable terror or rapturous joy, visions, near-death experiences, encounters with angels, heavenly voices, premonitions, the list goes on. Well, he explores many such stories in the book and asks, how should rationally minded people respond? And as well as talking through some of these accounts and the issues they raise, I'll be putting some questions that have been sent in by the Unbelievable audience as well to Dale. So, Dale, thank you for joining me again on today's show.
Thanks so much for having me, Justin.
Tell us a little bit about what prompted this particular book. People will know you as a historian, a New Testament scholar, and they might think, oh, Dale's gone into rather esoteric territory here. what do they make of it, your colleagues?
Oh, well, I don't know what my colleagues will make of it, but I don't really care anymore. So I'm far enough in my career that I don't have to worry about being hired again or getting a job or getting a raise. So, you know, I'm a full professor with tenure, and I've already made my reputation as an historian. So I really just want to be honest at this point. So, you know, you take a certain pose when you're in the academy. You write according to certain presuppositions. But I've always been interested in the subject in this book, going back to when I was a teenager. And I've always wanted to write this book, but I did not feel safe or confident or whatever the right word is, until relatively recent times. And then what happened, I teach at a seminary. I started teaching a class a few years ago called The Bible and Religious Experience, and it became quickly my favorite class. And I thought, well, I should turn this into a book. So once I, you know, talked about these subjects with students, with future pastors and others in the seminary, and after I got a good response, I thought, sure, why not? So yeah. The time's right for me. I'm only a few years from retirement, so you know it's time to be honest.
Yeah, you get to have a bit of fun once you don't have to worry so much about reputation and career. Tell me a little bit about the stories you start the book with, though, because you do start with some of your own personal experience in this area. Could you tell one or two of those stories?
Yeah, I'll tell a couple of stories. I don't really know. I'm a little uncomfortable with this because it's kind of like a postmodern conceit. I was taught by my teachers never to be autobiographical and just to be objective and use the we instead of I and all this stuff. But at some point I decided, well, I like it sometimes when authors are self-revealing, and it's a way of being honest. So what I do here is I begin at the beginning, at least my beginning, and I had an experience when I was 16 years old that I have lived with the entirety of my life. I've constantly repeated it to myself, and it came out of the blue. And the important thing here will not be the details, but the important thing really is the psychological fact that however one explains this, it really did direct the entire course of my life. That is, this thing which came out of nowhere made me passionate about God, about religion, and in my context, that meant the Bible, and that meant Jesus, and so on. Anyway, the way this goes is, one evening, I'm 16 years old, I'm living with my parents, I'm in high school, and I go out on the back porch. This is Kansas in the 1970s, so you could still see the stars frequently. So I'm out there just lost in thought, and I'm looking at the stars, and then something happens. It happens out of the blue. I didn't prepare for it. I didn't expect it, which is typical for these sorts of experiences. And also typical for these sorts of experiences is, although I'm going to give you words, the words can't get it, okay? So it doesn't make any sense what I'm going to say literally, but this is how it comes to speech for me. So it was as though the stars came down from the firmament, and as though they surrounded me, and they then announced the arrival or the presence of this great transcendent something. Now, of course, given my education and Christian background and so on, I naturally use the word God. But whatever this was, right, whoever this was, it was an overwhelming reality. And it actually flipped the way I think about things, and I have never recovered for this. So it was actually as though that was the really real, and the rest of the world isn't. So I guess from that point of view, it sounds a bit Platonic, like the real thing is not what you normally see. The real thing, the real reality behind all this is something greater. Anyway, this was a loving presence, but it was also an other. It was holy. It's kind of weird. You sort of mix these feelings of terror and adoration and affection all together somehow. I don't know how this works, but as I said, words aren't getting at this. This lasted, and I can't tell you whether this lasted 10 seconds or 30 seconds, but I know it didn't go beyond 30 seconds. And then it just wasn't there. It was there, and then it wasn't. And I didn't go tell my parents. I really didn't know what to do with this, except that I knew there were people in my social circle who went to church. And some of them were evangelicals, and I thought, okay, they're not going to make fun of me, so let's talk about this. And of course, they instantly said that I'd met Jesus, and they interpreted it as a conversion experience, although I was already saying my prayers and going to church and occasionally looking at the Bible and so on. But for them, it was a conversion experience, and that's how this all took off.
Yeah.
Of course, I ended up going to an evangelical church briefly, and they handed me the Bible and said, you know, this is what you need to do. And I did it. I read the whole thing. Then I read commentaries, and I got into this world, and I've never left it. Anyway, the point is, it's an experience that has effects that have lasted my whole life. And I say in the book, from one point of view, I'm not a professor at a seminary because I have a PhD and all that stuff. Really, I'm here because I had this experience, which I didn't seek and didn't cultivate, and just happened to me. So this is an experience that I treasure, and I've had some other, I don't know, mystical raptures, whatever you want to call them. But you asked for a couple of these. So the second one is almost the polar opposite of this. Although I learned after the fact, it's a really common experience. So what I'm about to share with you happens, according to the social psychologists now, to about 1 in 5 people, at least in North America, over the course of their lifetime. So I was asleep, and I woke up, and I could not move. I felt as though I could not breathe, right? I was totally panicked. I thought I might die. And what's weird about this is this came with the sense of some horrible, oppressive presence. And I didn't think the word Satan. I don't think I even thought the word demon, but the words would have, I guess, been appropriate. It was just some oppressive, horrible something. And I was petrified beyond comprehension, right? And I couldn't breathe. And most people who report this sort of event say that they prayed or tried to think a good thought or something, and then it just quickly dissipates. This is not as important, not nearly as important as the first experience, but it's similar in that I really don't have words. But some of this I know is objective because the experts have interviewed folks, and this experience, which is called sleep paralysis, frequently does come with the sense of an evil presence. And weirdly enough, it's usually at your feet to the left. Sometimes it's on your chest. But anyway, there are patterns to this experience. And anyway, so that's one good, and that's one bad.
It's a great introduction, because I think you do open yourself up, and what you say in the book is that the reason often these phenomena are underreported is because people feel embarrassed, or that people will think they've gone crazy or whatever. I could even tell you, you know, it rang bells with me reading your introduction in that way, because most people know me through my work in hosting shows like this, talking about the case for Christianity, apologetics, theology. And you know, that's an important part of why I'm a Christian. But actually, if I were to be really autobiographical and honest, it really came back to an experience I had as a 15-year-old, which, different to yours, but nevertheless, something that it would be very hard to put into words, but where faith came alive for me because of a deep experience of what I would call the Holy Spirit, but which essentially was something that just, you know, turned me on to the love of God in a way that, you know, a logical argument or something, you know, couldn't possibly reach you in the same way. And I'm sometimes shy of saying that, in intellectual circles, because people will look down at you and say, oh yes, well, you've just came because of emotion and feeling and all the rest of it. But like you, I kind of want to say, well, actually, you know, it's always a mixture, but yes, there was this very significant emotional component to my experience.
So one of the things I spend, I don't know, two or three pages on in the book is something called TASTE, T-A-S-T-E, which is a site on the internet. And it's a site where scientists can report transcendent, mystical, religious, and paranormal experiences. And the site exists because the people who contribute to it feel that they have no place to share what's happened to them. So there's a little online site, a safe community, right? Because if you share it with your friends down the hall in the biology department, it's not going to go well. So there's a social censorship, which is implicit. There are truly amazing instances of this. One, I'll just do this briefly. There was a psychologist, Genevieve Foster was her name. And I think she was a Jungian. And in the 1960s, she was attending a Unitarian church, and she wasn't into, you know, traditional Christianity. She wasn't a mystic at all. And then she had this experience. And as she describes it, there was a numinous presence which just showed up in the room, and it was radiating love. And she was totally, totally overwhelmed. It lasted a long time, and it changed the way that she thought about everything. Now, here's what's interesting. She did go to her minister and share this, and he said he thought it might have something to do with menopause. He was really uncomfortable with this. And she shared it with her mentor, who was a Jungian analyst, and he said, no, you can't trust this. It's just no good. Forget it. But she couldn't forget it. And what happened is, as she got older, she got sick at one point, and she was writing a memoir for her family so her children and grandchildren would know who she was and so on. And in this memoir, she decided, well, heck, I might as well tell the truth, which is, this happened to me 40 years ago. I've kept it a secret, but it's the most important thing that ever happened to me, right? The most important thing that ever happened to me, and here we go. By the way, the only comfort and consolation and support she could find was to read literature of mystics. So she read Evelyn Underhill's old classic Mysticism, right, and thought, okay, I'm not crazy. Other people have had similar experiences. I'm okay. I still can't talk about it, but now, you know, yeah, right? So, that sort of thing plays out again and again and again.
Well, we'll come to talk about, obviously, sort of, to what extent we can say these are veridical or purely subjective experiences, and to what extent they do or do not lend any kind of evidence towards the existence of God or Christianity specifically. But let's talk about some of the experiences, which you've gone to all kinds of sources to locate, both historically and contemporary. I mean, we're only going to be able to pick just a small handful from the book, which covers all kinds of bases. But I mean, you start with the sort of a number of experiences of what you might call overwhelming love. That's the pretty common sort of type of experience that a lot of people report. Again, comes in all kinds of shapes and forms, the way people experience that. But do you want to kind of elaborate on a story or so about that?
Well, so the first experience I shared with you when I was 16 is a version of that, right? Okay. I think the easiest thing to do would be to refer, if I may do so, on a podcast, to a book. There's a man called Mark Fox who wrote a book called The Fifth Love, and he's playing upon C.S. Lewis's idea of the four loves. And what he's doing then is he's collecting accounts, which are really, really, really common, of this sense of a numinous, loving, invisible presence that overwhelms people. And people who are Christians automatically use Christian language for this. They will say, for example, God is love, and I experienced this. So they're quoting the New Testament, right? But there are also people who have this who are who are not in a church or not in a religious context, and they may use different words for this experience. But if you read it carefully, read their accounts carefully, it sounds like it's very much the same thing. So as I say in the book, this is an experience that is consistent with Christian doctrine, right? Mm-hmm. You know, a Sufi can interpret it a slightly different way, or a devotional Hindu could interpret it in a different way. So it's consistent with the idea that God is love, but it doesn't establish, I guess, a particularly Christian theistic point of view. And that's actually true for the experiences in this book in general. So sometimes people have asked me what I'm doing here. And they think, well, am I engaged in natural revelation, you know, am I setting that against special revelation and so on? What I think I'm doing is this. I think I'm making a space for the possibility of theological or Christian theological assertions. So I was raised, I was educated into a materialistic, reductionistic view of the world. That was my college education, right? And all my professors, almost all of them were atheists, and they were evangelistic about it, and they were reductionistic about all religion, so that theological statements didn't even have a possibility of getting started, right? What this book is for me is it's sort of like Eusebius's preparation for the gospel. It's not gospel, but it's preparation for the gospel. It's at least raises the possibility. One of the blurbers used the word proof. I'm allergic to that. I don't like that in this connection. But it raises the possibility, some of these stories do, that there is more to the world than my teachers taught me, and that many people believe, and certainly many secular materialists think. Okay? So that's how I think about this.
That's helpful. I mean, just sticking with some of the accounts before we kind of come again to sort of the question of how we interpret them. Angelic encounters, that is something that seems to be common across the world in many different traditions. I'll just give one example that you give in the book here. There's the story of 3-year-old Danny Agnes of Bethpage in New York, and you describe how one morning the little boy was recklessly running full tilt across his living room rug when he tripped and fell headfirst towards the sharp corner of a table. But as his horrified mother looked on, the child's forward fall was suddenly and inexplicably halted. Somehow, he was stood up and moved over to continue on his happy, oblivious way. Now, it is the sequel, you say, that gives this story its punch and sets it in the long-term memory. The next day, we are told, Danny, while at play, suddenly looked up and addressed his mother. "Mummy, I saw a beautiful lady with wings." The mother, supposing her son to be recounting fantasy, replied, "Really, Danny, what is the lady like?" There followed this: "She's nice. She caught me yesterday, so I didn't hit my head against the table. She said she was going to watch over me and keep me from getting hurt." So now that's just one small story in many, many. But yeah, do you want to just give a bit of context?
First of all, I am clear repeatedly that unless a story is told by me or somebody really close to me that I've interviewed multiple times, I cannot confirm this.
Of course.
What I'm really doing is I'm looking for patterns in stories. And one of the really odd things, I'm not sure what to make of it, but if you're being honest with the literature, one of the really odd things is that these angel books, which have been around since the late 80s, early 90s, and lots and lots and lots of them, and lots of them have been best-selling books. They sell way more than anything I've ever written. They have an influence on the culture. One of the things is that there is a subcategory of what I call anti-gravity stories. And these are stories in which people fall and float to the ground rather than just going splat. Or, they're leaning over and they're going to fall, and then some invisible force straightens them up and they don't get smashed by the car that's going by. Mm. Or the story that you just read. So there are a slew of these anti-gravity stories. And by the way, I think that, so if you read these angel books, you'll find that there are all sorts of different things that are interpreted as angels. So you hear a warning voice and someone says angel, or you fall and don't get hurt and someone says angel. there are all sorts of different things that are stuck into this one category, and I think they should be sorted into different piles. The anti-gravity thing in Christianity is related to Psalm 90 and to Matthew 4 and to Luke 4. And the passage about the angels will lift you up, will hold you up, you know. Jesus quotes that when he's tempted by the devil. And I think that's worked itself into our Christian culture. And so that when some miraculous rescue happens where it seems like you're picked up or lifted or somehow you defy gravity, we think angel, right? By the way, academics don't pay attention to this literature. They just don't pay attention. They're allergic to it. But if you read these books, a lot of them are just reporting what people said happened to them.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of them are just quotations or emails or letters. Some of them, one of them even comes with books and names and, I mean, with pictures and, you know, so-and-so who lives such-and-such a place. They're just little snippets of what people claim have happened to them. And I think if we have so many people saying these things happened, we should at least take notice. It's at least a psychological fact that people think these sorts of things happened to them. Now, the angel chapter is actually the most skeptical, I think, in the book. But I do say that if my experience were like one of the individuals, I just say an angel. There's a story there of a woman who sees her child, and he's crawled in the backyard out onto the railroad tracks. And a train is coming, and she looks and realizes she doesn't have enough time, right, to get there. And then she has a vision of a angelic being, a luminous figure who lifts her son off the tracks, puts him down gently. The train goes by, and she says, an angel. Well, if that happened to me, I probably would say an angel, right? I would. I mean, I could say, well, I psychokinetically raised my child off the tracks through my own power, and then I hallucinated a luminous being. I could do that, but I wouldn't. I'd just say angel. So some of these stories, if they occurred as claimed, do raise interesting questions. What really happened? Yeah. And for me, it's exciting to ask the question anyway. Yeah. Do we live in a world in which something like that could happen? Or do we live in a world in which that's absolutely impossible and I'm a moron for even giving it a second thought?
Well, I think that's the point, is you're not, as you've said, you're not claiming that all of these stories are you know, fully evidenced or anything. You're just noting that there are similarities across many, many stories, that similar themes emerge and so on. And we need to at least give them the time of day to ask, okay, is there something in this? Or is it all, can we simply discount all of it as people's overactive imaginations on?
Yeah, and especially one, because a lot of these experiences that I'm looking at get associated with the word God, which gets my attention, should get a pastor's attention. And the other thing is that these events that I'm talking about often form people's lives. That is, they're not just some interesting thing that happened and they recall it once in a while.
Yeah.
They can change the way they view of the world or the way they think about God. And so on. So if experiences, these sorts of experiences I'm talking about, if they really do affect people on a profound psychological level, we need to look at that even apart from the question of transcendence and God and so on.
And you also acknowledge, though, in the book that just as, you know, and this is an area you don't actually cover in the book, the supernatural healing, but just as supernatural healing raises questions about God's providence, well, why would God heal one and not another? Apparently miraculous stories of angels do the same thing. You know, it raises as many questions as it answers sometimes, because, well, why did God save that child and not the other? So as a skeptic, you know, I get the you get the sense when you read this book, Dale, that you're a sort of naturally skeptical person, even though you say, I have had strange experiences, and you don't simply take things as read. You're like many of us who are built a bit more skeptical, wired a bit more skeptical, you're sort of asking, well, yeah, but how does that figure if there is a God who is just? Why would he do this in one case and not another?
Yeah. So theologically, I have no answer for that at all. Yeah. But I do try throughout briefly to show that I'm familiar with reductionistic or materialistic explanations that dismiss everything. And I argue throughout the book that, no, maybe we should pay some attention here. Yeah. Or isn't this an odd fact if there's nothing beyond imagination here, right? So I like to think of myself as in constant dialogue with skeptics, but that's because skepticism was internalized by me. So I've always been a religious person who also had skeptical thoughts and been confused and wondered and changed his mind and so on. So it's not as though, honestly, it's not as though I'm an apologist and I know everything before I start and I'm going to defend everything that I want to. It's more like, okay, look at this. Let's try to think honestly about this. And aren't there hints here and there that some of this is truly remarkable, right?
So and you're trying to be open-minded. We'll go to a quick break, and we'll be back in just a second. We're going to talk. I want to just open up as well another area that you talk about in the book: near-death experiences or what happens shortly before people pass on, and that sort of thing. And also, of course, how this may or may not relate to your main area of study: the claims around the resurrection of Jesus and the experiences of the disciples. So we'll come back to all that, plus questions from the Unbelievable audience. We will get to some of those questions in the next section of today's show. But today on Unbelievable, I'm talking with historian Dale Allison. His new book is called, I've got it right here, Encountering Mystery, Religious Experience in a Secular Age. We'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. I'm talking today with Dale Allison. He's a New Testament scholar, but he's recently turned his hand to talking about all kinds of interesting, often esoteric, religious experiences. It's in his new book, Encountering Mystery, Religious Experience in a Secular Age. I'll make sure there's a link to Dale and the book from today's show, but we've been talking already about things like numinous experiences of joy and love that so many people relate, or indeed sometimes terrifying encounters. Sleep paralysis that Dale has himself once experienced is one example of that. Also, of course, angelic visitation, something Dale is, skeptical of, as he said, certainly throughout the book he's not taking these stories that he's found and researched as read, but simply saying that. But there are interesting overlaps, patterns that emerge. However skeptical you may be, you have to take something seriously about this. I mean, one area which is perhaps a little bit more researched in this area and has come up quite frequently actually on the show, Dale, is near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. So that is sort of out-of-body type experiences when people are maybe under anaesthetic or perhaps, medically sort of, their heart stopped or whatever. But also another interesting phenomenon you talk about is people who are approaching death and the experiences very often that relatives and carers see in their final moments. In fact, one interesting, I think the phenomenon is called terminal lucidity, that there's been some research in, which is this idea that even people who have had very severe brain damage or brain disease, Alzheimer's and so on, that there is, a phenomenon where it has been seen some of these patients or people shortly before death can suddenly have very lucid moments, and then they suddenly seem to go. And I don't know whether sort of where do you go with that kind of story and what
so
that might
I
tell
don't
us?
Know I don't know what to do with it. Actually, this is now being investigated by serious medical people, but I need to caution, this is very rare and nobody should get hopes up. It's just a bizarre phenomenon. So somebody who's had dementia for 5 years and they're approaching death, can or has woken up and just returned to normal for a few minutes or half an hour or an hour. We don't understand how this works at all. But it does make you wonder about our understanding of the brain. It's one of those little things that just shouldn't be. If everything's gone and everything's dissolved and none of the connections have worked, how can you all of a sudden get back to normal? The people who have witnessed this are astounded.
I mentioned it. It particularly struck me because it came up just briefly in another conversation we've had on this show not so long ago with Ian McGilchrist. I don't know if you know the name, but he's a psychiatrist and a very interesting sort of brain researcher who talked about it in connection with sort of the whole question of consciousness. And and Ian subscribes to what is becoming an increasingly common form of view on consciousness and the mind-body issue, against a kind of materialistic perspective, a sort of panpsychist perspective. And he just wondered, and again, it was very, you know, tentative and, there's not a lot of research out there and this isn't a very common experience, but he just wondered whether there was something about when, as it were, the physical stuff starts to kind of step back, whether there's a sort of suddenly consciousness kind of can sort of almost, appear more. It's that it was always there. It was just the machinery was broken in kind of bringing it through. And perhaps there's just something about, you know, at those few moments before death, that veil gets lifted in some way. I don't know.
No, that's very interesting. It's congenial to my own thought. And it's actually parallel to the way some people think about near-death experiences. So in some near-death experiences, allegedly, the people have been dead, at least to all appearances, they've been dead, and their brain is not functioning. Yet they will report these very detailed, involved, lively experiences when nothing's supposedly going on, right? So is that the same sort of thing that's happening? They're also, now I just put this in a footnote, and I don't want to get into it but there are some people who've suggested that certain hallucinogens actually work by shutting down the brain, by turning it off, and that whatever consciousness is, it's actually getting more active and wild and unconstrained and so on. It's not that the material thing is, you know, the neurons are causing this, but the neurons are actually being depressed. Now, again, I'm not a neuroscientist. I can't vouch for this. I'm just telling you I've read this in a few places, right? And it sort of fits maybe this pattern, maybe terminal lucidity and maybe near-death experience. As maybe, by the way, maybe, again, I'm not a neuroscientist, so maybe I shouldn't be saying anything. But I have read neuroscientists who have had these thoughts. I also, with regard to terminal lucidity, I did run into some Christian German apologist from like 100 years ago who thought it was, you know, one of his little pieces of evidence for something like a soul, for the possibility of life beyond body, because he said this doesn't have a mechanistic explanation. I do know you can say this. It's not what you would expect on a mechanistic view of things. It's not what the reductionistic materialist would prophesy. Oh, yeah, I think once in a while when people don't have brains, they're going to be lucid. That just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it goes against expectations. I mean, when it comes to the quite more widely reported phenomenon of these near-death experiences where people apparently, you know, maybe on the operating table have seen something they couldn't possibly have known about in the room happening around them, you know, the shoe on top of the hospital building that the nurse later found. There's a sense in which that then takes us a little bit further, in my view, from the sort of very subjective experiences, which are hard to verify, to something that seems a bit more veridical. I mean, what's your view on that? Are those kinds of examples edging us towards something where, hey, there might be a bit of evidence here that we're not dealing with a purely materialistic world?
Yes, I think so. So there was a book published 5 or 6 years ago called The Self Does Not Die, and it collects examples of supposedly veridical experiences during NDEs, which were confirmed by third-party observers. Now, the way I approach this in the book is I simply string together, I don't know, I put a lot, maybe 10 quotations together from surgeons, attending physicians, nurses, and so on, who were with people when they were out of it, when they were unconscious, when they shouldn't have known anything was going on. And then they talk to the patient who has awakened, and the patient says things that the patient should not know. And I've chosen these quotations because they're not from Christian apologists. They're from attending medical personnel. And in each case, they say, I don't get this. It doesn't make any sense. It shouldn't have happened. And my question in the book is just, how many of these do we need? Do we need 600? Do we need 49? I don't know, but I've read enough already that I think, yeah, these people are sometimes reporting things that they cannot know. They just can't know. Actually, one of the famous near-death experience experts, a man named Bruce Grayson at the University of Virginia, he got into this because of a patient who told him about, I think it was some mustard that was on his tie. The patient was completely out of it, right? And he was talking to the patient later, and the patient told him things that had been going on with him down the hall, and the patient wasn't there. Mm. And they were true, right?
Yeah.
And the patient said, you know, I had this experience while I was supposedly dead or near death, and I saw things. And they were true. So that got him into the field, right? He didn't start out as an apologist or believing this. In fact, he didn't know what to make of this, but it got him started. So if you have testimony like that, at some point the mountain of testimony is enough for me to say, yes, this is is real.
Yeah,
but let me add something else here because it's important. Sometimes people who explain away experiences are presumptuous. So if you have ever sat down and talked to people who've had near-death experiences, and I've had, one of the things that is really impressive is that most of them will say, this was real. It wasn't a dream. I wasn't hallucinating. I had one friend once who said, I thought it was all baloney till it happened to me. Mm-hmm. Now I know it is not baloney, right? Or people who say, this is the most important thing that ever happened to me. It wasn't a hallucination. Mm-hmm. Or, as I say in the book, I was on a panel once with a little bit of a debate with a philosopher who had written a skeptical book on near-death experiences, and I was more open-minded. And a man came up. And he talked to this skeptic for quite a while. Then he came over to me, and I naturally said, what were you guys talking about? And his response was, I told him he had no idea what he was talking about because I went down the tunnel, and I saw everything, and it's really real, and he just doesn't know. Now, people can deceive themselves, and we can be confident about false opinions. Still, this is the kind of thing that makes you wonder. If you talk to enough of these people, and who are we to look at them when we haven't had this experience and say, I know you all are just making this up, or you're lying, or you're hallucinating, or you had too much carbon in your blood. It's just really, it's not respectful maybe, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, look, one thing I did want to raise just while we're on the subject of death is that another thing you deal with nearer to the beginning of the book is grief visions. So that this again is a fairly common phenomenon whereby people who've recently lost a loved one have a sense of them being with them. In fact, I seem to remember C.S. Lewis himself writing about this once, about the sense of a very dear friend being almost physically present with him after the loss of someone. And I've heard this myself from other people in one form or another. Now, without going into those stories too much, what immediately leapt to mind was thinking of your other main aspect of your work, Dale, the New Testament accounts, and particularly, you know, the experiences recorded there of the followers of Jesus. When we last spoke and had that discussion with Justin Bass, you know, you explained that you do believe in the resurrection, but not necessarily in a sort of very physical flesh and blood resurrection, necessarily. I may be putting words in your mouth. Anyway, but the point being that it made me wonder, well, I wonder if Dale's research in these sorts of experiences makes him think that that might be more akin to what the disciples had experienced, some kind of grief hallucination or vision. Where do you go with that?
Okay, so when you use the word hallucination or grief vision, most people understand you to be talking about pure subjective projection. So one of the things that I have trouble with is I do not believe that all visionary experiences are totally endogenous. I do not believe they're all of them are purely subjective. I think it's possible to come into contact with external realities through visions. All right. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I'm not a reductionist at all. And I certainly nowhere say, okay, here's what I know about grief visions. And this explains everything about early Christianity. That's not true. For one thing, they don't give the category of resurrection. For another thing, I think the tomb was probably empty. And I think this has an important effect in how to understand what's going on in the early church. But has this affected me? The answer is yes, it's undeniable. And part of the reason, I don't think I wrote about this in this book, but I have written about it elsewhere. I did have a very, very dear friend die. And 3 days after her death, I don't know how to put this into words, but she woke me up. I was asleep. She woke me up. She was standing at the end of my bed. And she did not say anything. Unlike Jesus, she didn't say anything. But I do remember thinking at the time, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. And whoever is in this state would be the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It was a very encouraging, edifying few moments for me. I also have to say that when my father died, I had no contact. I didn't see him, hear him. But I had a story from my wife. I had a story from my six-year-old son. I had a story from my brother. I had a story from my mother. I had a story from a friend. They just lined up to tell me about their postmortem encounters with Clifford. And it was amazing. And, you know, I could quiz a couple of these people in great detail about what happened right after it happened. And it is hard for me, I must confess, it's hard for me to think that they were all just independently hallucinating something. I'm inclined to think that my post-mortem father for a few days was really active and had a lot of things he needed to deal with.
What
do I do with it?
Yeah. Well, what you don't do is simply dismiss it as all crazy nonsense. And you're keen to say, look, it's mysterious and it may not even fit your theological categories, but it's there. People say this happened and you can't just dismiss that.
Yeah. But so the other thing, though, to say the last thing about this, the resurrection business is I don't know what a resurrected body is. I have no idea what this means. But when I read the accounts in the Gospels, it's not like my body. It really is. He pops in. He just pops in the Gospel of John. I can't do that. I've never seen anybody do that. And it looks like he just pops out, right? And when he's there, one of the notes in all the stories, really interesting, is that there's some kind of doubt. So what is this doubt about? And anyway, I don't think that this is just a guy who walked into a room, I mean, that he just walked out of the tomb. Actually, in Matthew, he's gone from the tomb before it's opened. So he's gone to another dimension or passed through the wall or something. Anyway, my point is that I have no trouble with saying that the appearances were vision-like experiences because they have some features of visionary experiences. That doesn't mean I know what they are. My heresy, I guess my heresy is that whatever state Jesus entered, I think he entered it on Saturday night or Sunday morning, not later on. Not like he, John Calvin thought he was just walking around, and he was just like you and me. And it, I guess he has lungs and he's breathing air and so on. I think he's entered some sort of other something.
Yeah, whatever that resurrection body thing is.
And then he's
I don't know.
And he's coming back and communicating from whatever that is, from wherever that is. And I just don't think it's like ordinary communication. So that makes me a heretic.
Well, maybe it makes Paul a heretic as well, who says, you know, that the corruptible body will put on the incorruptible. Now, he doesn't say what that is, but it's obviously not you and me standing here in our corruptible bodies. It's going to be some kind of different type of, you know, experience.
But he knows it's strange and very different. First Corinthians is not an easy chapter, as you know, and he's not always clear. And finally, at the end, he says, well, I'll tell you a mystery. He could have introduced that word in every sentence along the way. He didn't have to save it for the end.
what we have saved for the end of today's show is some of the questions that have come in. We've got lots of them. In fact, let's stick with the resurrection just for one question. A few people wanted to ask you resurrection questions, but I think we'll try and limit those and get to more of the religious experience ones. But here's just one from John David Walters, who, by the way, has read the new book already and says he thinks Encountering Mystery is this century's Varieties of Religious Experience, a monumental achievement to summarize such a broad range of contemporary experience using the best scholarship in so few pages. So there you go. You've got your first review in already from John David Walters. But John, he has this particular question. Where do you rank the evidential quality of the resurrection experiences compared with other religious paranormal experiences, such as Joseph of Cupertino or the Tibetan rainbow body claims? And I guess the point is there are lots of other, you know, claimed sort of evidences for supernatural events in other religions. How do you rank the evidential quality of the resurrection account?
So here's the sad fact. You would like the evidential quality for the resurrection to be the best of everything. But the problem is the evidence comes from 2,000 years ago. So I regard the best evidenced events to be things that have happened recently, where we can interview tons and tons of people and get firsthand accounts. So we really don't have Peter's first-person account of what happened, and we don't have Mary Magdalene's first-person account of what happened. We have a couple of texts that were written half a century later. So I think, for example, that if the sources for Joseph of Cupertino are what we have been told, so there are people who've been to the Vatican, looked at the canonization proceedings, translated and read them and so on. If those people are right, we have over 100 people saying that they saw Joseph of Cupertino fly or float or levitate, right? Including people who didn't want him to or weren't expecting him to. And the Grand Inquisitor, the person in charge of beatification, after about 100 of these said, there's no point in interviewing anymore. We got lots more, but they're all saying the same thing. So we've decided this happened. Now, by the way, for me, if the reports are correct about this this stash in the Vatican basement mysteriously and all this, if they're true, this is one of the best attested inexplicable events in history, all right? It just is. As far as Tibetan rainbow bodies, I've gotten myself in trouble with some people, but I've been perfectly clear. I have no idea what's going on. I have honestly no opinion. I'm simply calling attention to an ongoing tradition where people are making certain claims. I'm no expert. I don't know how to evaluate them. I'm just looking at them. So I have no opinion about that. Maybe in 50 years, we'll have enough experts, and they've looked into this, and they'll say, wow, this is incredible. Nobody can figure it out. Or they'll say, no, we've decided this is fraud or something else. But at this point in time, I don't know. Let me give you one example of something that I think is better attested than the resurrection, and I don't know what to make of it. My Coptic Christian friends think I should just say Mary appeared to people, but it's hard for me to get there. Anyway, in a suburb of Cairo, in a little place called Zaytoun, in a Coptic church in the late 1960s, there was an apparition, a luminous figure, and it was seen by... The question is, was it tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people? Some were secular, some were Christian, some were Muslim. We have a few photographs of this. It was covered in the news at the time. The local authorities tried to figure out what was going on while it was going on. Anyway, the point is, we have tons of stuff. We still have living witnesses. I had a student 3 years ago handed a paper. He had interviewed a bunch of people who had seen this, older Egyptians who were living in New Jersey and had been there at the time. So I think this is an inexplicable event, right? You could say it's Mary. I mean, people who saw it, many of them said it looked like Mary. It was on Mary's church, you know, and so on. It's really, really well attested. I wish the resurrection were like that. As you know, we have to do inferences and so on and so on. This, you just read the testimony, and after testimony, you know, number 30, you think, this is real. I have no explanation for it. I've also looked into the few dismissals of it, you know, what could this earthquake, lights, you know, weird. Nothing works. Nothing works. So it's a well-attested event. It's helpful here, by the way, Justin, at least for me, to recall that Christians have traditionally, or at least Catholics in the Middle Ages, have traditionally worked with two categories. There's one category called wonder, and there's another called miracle. And a miracle is characterized by we can't explain it, it's inexplicable, and God was the agent. A wonder is it's inexplicable, and we don't know who the agent was, right? For me, there are these things where I say, I'm not a reductionistic materialist. I think this happened, but I'm not sure that God is the agent. And then I just say, okay, isn't this a weird place I live in? All right?
Yeah. That's fine. We'll leave it there, and I'm not going to press you any further because I do want to get some other questions. But thank you for your honesty in just sort of saying, you know, that's where it is. Very simple question, and forgive me, I'm going to mispronounce this person's name, but I think it's something like Zbigniew Azmierzak. But forgive me, the person who tweeted this in, which he simply asks, does he believe in the devil? Now, this is interesting to me because what prompted me in the book was also the negative experiences that you relate, including the one you just described, the sleep paralysis. And inevitably, lots of people have ascribed a sort of, you know, demonic forces being responsible for those. And you yourself raised the question of, you know, if it's, you know, so common for people to associate God with the positive experiences, isn't it natural to assume there must be a sort of negative spiritual dimension to life as well? Where do you go with that, and do you draw any conclusions on that, Dale?
Okay, so on this matter, I'm both a liberal and a conservative, all right? So I don't really fit any box. So I'm a modern human being who thinks that the word spirit is useful, it has utility, it refers to things that we can't see. But and I think some of those invisible spirits or presences are good. I think some of them are bad. And I also, this isn't so much in my Christian tradition, think that there are probably all sorts of weird things in between. So that makes me conservative in the sense that, yes, I don't think human beings are the only thing around. Okay? And I think some of the things that are around mean us harm. But ontologically or metaphysically, I have no idea how to explain that. And that's because traditionally, Satan and his demons are a sort of exegetical construct. That is, you take certain biblical verses and you end up with a biography. Satan was an angel. and he was the highest of all angels. And then through pride, he fell after he led the choirs because he liked music and singing a lot. Mm. And then he came down here and he tempted Adam and Eve. You actually get a biography or a history. So I regard the history as mostly bad exegesis, all right? Mm-hmm. So I don't have a story. I simply recognize that there are evil things in the world, and our tradition mm-hmm. has used the name Satan, and it's used the word demon, Satan, for kind of the big, thing, and then demons for little things, and try to relate them. So on the metaphysical, ontological, historical, biographical questions, where do these things come from? You know, mm-hmm. what is this? I'm just a liberal. I'm agnostic, and I don't see maybe the word would be mythological. So, you know, Satan has horns and a tail and all this stuff. Mm. I think a lot of the things that people think of when they think of as Satan are mythological. But what makes me a conservative is I think that the construct actually represents things that are real out there that oppress us.
There is a kind of, there's an objective reality to that sort of spiritual dimension.
Yeah.
I guess, I'm interested, this takes us beyond what you actually write in the book, but, you know, you could have done a whole chapter on, you know, the phenomenon of exorcism and that sort of thing, you know, that exists in many traditions. But, like, even if you're not prepared to say that there is a sort of, you know, literal devil in the sense that he's been given that sort of history from scripture, do you kind of recognize, I suppose, that ministry of people being healed from that kind of oppression in the name of Jesus, as it were?
Yes, with caution, because you can do anything with demons, and everything has been done with demons. But what the Roman Catholic Church does in theory makes sense to me. So you have somebody with some horrific condition, and certain things seem inexplicable, but what you do is you run through, in theory, the medical gauntlet. You go to the psychologists, you go to the medical doctors, you go to the neurologists, you go to everybody, and if they all come up and they say, we can't help, and we're not sure what's going on, then at that point you call in the exorcist, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in theory, each area in North America where I live has an exorcist that's called in once in a while for these sorts of cases. And if you read the literature, they are sometimes, maybe many times, successful or moderately successful, and I see no reason to object to that or think that anything is wrong with it. I will tell you that I do know cases of Protestant ministers who have occasionally, been faced with a claim of exorcism, and one of the things some of them do is say, we need to call in the Roman Catholics because they're the experts on this. We just didn't learn about this at, you know, Princeton Theological Seminary. But I also know of pastors who have just taken a pastoral approach and just said, okay, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to go to a house and I'm going to read the Bible and I'll say some prayers and, you know, I'll do a sort of amateur casting out or whatever. And they tell me that, you know, it sometimes works.
Yeah. And likewise, there's equally the opposite end of the spectrum where people are so, you know, willing to put everything on demons and devils and so on. So there's always extremes in these cases. But we're going to go to another break and then we'll come back with some more questions because we've got lots more that I'd have to get to before we finish up. We're talking about the new book by Dale Allison, Encountering Mystery, here on Unbelievable Today. He's my guest, and we'll be back in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hi there, welcome back, and we'll be returning to the conversation with Dale Allison shortly here on the show. But coming up later on tonight, special programming ahead of the Queen's funeral this Monday. That continues here on Premier Christian Radio. Thanks to all those who've been in touch with their thanks for this past week's webinar that we ran on Tuesday night, addressing power, leadership and abuse in the church. Stephen said, listening to the Falling from Grace webinar, thank you, Justin, for making this happen. Megan said, can't thank you enough for bringing together the amazing live panel. It was 4 a.m. for me in South Korea. Well done for getting up that early for it, Megan. You say it brought wisdom, tools and hope, and I think for many others too. Unbelievable remains the gold standard. Very kind words. Thank you. Well, the good news is, if you weren't able to be with us in person and ask questions yourself, we are going to be broadcasting what happened on next week's show. So expect that both on podcast, radio and video. It was the panel discussion between Rachel Den Hollander, Amy Orr Ewing, Mike Cosper and Diane Langberg. They all joined me along with hundreds of unbelievable listeners. And we partnered with 31.8, the UK's leading independent Christian safeguarding charity for this. Very important subjects and powerful moments during the evening. You'll be able to hear and watch it all next week. Do make sure you subscribe to our newsletter, by the way, to be alerted about things like upcoming webinars, special events and so on. PremierUnbelievable.com for that. You can check out the links with today's show if you're listening via podcast. We've just got time for some of your questions in this final segment of today's show. I've been talking with New Testament scholar Dale Allison from Princeton Theological Seminary. He says, though, now that he's sort of, you know, got his career, you know, more or less sorted, he can do crazy book projects like this one, Encountering Mystery, where he tells all kinds of weird and strange stories of religious experience, but says, look, skeptics just have to take it that these things, you know, happened, at least for these people, they were very real, and we can't just dismiss those, trash those. We need to take some, we need to look at the patterns and the similarities and so on. And I think you walk a very fine line here, Dale, you know, in terms of trying to reassure people that you're not just buying all these stories hook, line and sinker, but at the same time you want people to retain an open mind, as you say. And we're going to take some questions kind of along those lines here. There's a couple that have similar-ish sort of themes here. So Andrew Parker, who's a Christian, says, in Dale's view, can any form of religious experience impart a conviction in terms of God's reality that withstands critical doubt for the person receiving it? And he quotes here Anthony Flew, who once said, apparently, how and when would we be justified in making inferences from the facts of the occurrence of religious experience considered as a purely psychological phenomenon to conclusions about the supposed objective religious truths? And Matthew Taylor, who's an atheist writing in, has a similar question, says, you know, does he believe any of these experiences come from the Christian God? And if so, what's the process for verifying that? So these are questions along the lines of can any of these experiences ever provide some kind of evidence for the reality of God, and in particular, the Christian God?
So I don't know how that would happen. That is, to a third person. So Flew is speaking as an outsider, right? And mm-hmm. he's saying that whatever I'm being told, that won't work for me, whatever it is, because it's subjective or internal. But the fact is, the psychological fact, the historical fact is that these experiences do persuade many people who have them. So the question, can these experiences create conviction? The answer is, without any question, yes, because they have in many, 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 many people. The problem is, how do we verify them from the outside? Now, when it comes to near-death experiences, you could do something with veridical perception. At least I think you can. I think that's been done. But what do you do with these other experiences? You can look at them, do a little bit of natural history, if you will, say, okay, here are these kinds of stories, here are these kinds of stories, here are these kinds of stories. Can we just explain them away in terms of neurons and chemicals and so on? So I'm here's the thing. I am not a person who thinks that everything true has to be subject to objective empirical science. And in fact, I think most important things are not. So if you were to ask me how I would, empirically verify the meaning of the Brothers Karamazov, it just makes no sense. You read the book, it's profound, you live into it. It has nothing to do with science. I don't think the Golden Rule has anything to do with science or the parable of the prodigal son. These things just come and haunt you and make you act in a certain way, or guilty when you don't act in a certain way. And these experiences are similar. They have profound meaning for people. And at least just pastorally or psychologically, you need to acknowledge that. And by the way, Christian pastors often don't, because they're uneasy for one reason or another with things. That's their mistake. They need to take people seriously as experiencers. So many people are like me. I didn't seek things. They just happened. They were out of the blue. I didn't cultivate them. It's not my fault. My way of thinking about this is just part of being human. And if you want to sit from the outside and say, well, how do I document this or prove that it's really real? I just don't know how to do that. So,
And anything to say to the kind of question about, well, which God? So Matthew says, specifically for the Christian God, and Nathan Forster asks a related question, which is, from the point of view of someone who believes in the Christian God being the one and only God, how then would you account theologically for people of other faiths having visions in their respective religions of, that relate to their own gods? And I suppose that relates to the whole question of whether these experiences themselves tend to be culturally situated. Do they tend to pick up on the aspects of the religion that people are raised in and that sort of thing? So do you think that there's any sense in which these corroborate a specific religious sort of, perspective, i.e. Christianity?
So no, I don't think this is the way. I mean, maybe you would want to say this this can be allied in some way with what we call natural theology, but natural theology doesn't give you Christianity. Natural theology might give you some reason to believe in a God or a creator or a life after this or something like that, but it's not going to give you the message of the New Testament. The only thing that's going to give you the message of the New Testament is the New Testament. But I think in response to the larger question, we really need to think seriously about perception. So let me go to near-death experiences and just stay with me for a second. So you read the literature, the first-hand accounts of near-death experiences, people will often describe seeing a being of light. And they will sometimes use that term, a being of light. But it's quite clear to me that some of the people are seeing the same thing and using the word God. And others are seeing the same thing and using the word Jesus. And some, from Hindu accounts, are seeing the same thing, and they are using the name of a Hindu god. All right? So we do perceive and we interpret and we remember according to the categories that we have. Now, a Christian might want to argue that this really is the Logos. This is really Jesus. Or, as some people think, I don't know how you make these sorts of decisions. Many Christians say angel. They don't say Jesus. They say angel. Okay, but here's the thing. I think a lot of these people are having very similar experiences. And because they are, they're not purely subjective, but they are giving different accounts of it. So there's another part of near-death experiences that I talk about in the book that's really fascinating. So often people will say, I came to the point where I knew if I went on, I couldn't come back. And they will talk about a bridge, a river, a valley, a door, a wall. They will use different, what I think must be metaphors, but this is how they're remembering it. They're remembering some sort of border or barrier, but they actually perceived it, or they're remembering it in different ways. But I think it's the same experience. So my sense of this is that even ordinary perception, as we now know, according to the neuroscientists, involves projection and filling in the blanks. You know, we just have, if we're talking about our eyes, we have light rays that come in, and then we do all the stuff, right? Yeah. And they can actually show us how we're filling in blanks and using past experience to interpret and so on. So even perception of this world involves subjectivity and projection. So if we're ever in contact with this this world that we're not so used to, these other realities that our brains aren't really plugged into all the time, it makes sense that the subjectivity would be even greater. So that's one way of beginning to think about this problem, it seems to me.
Some other related questions then to NDEs came in. Dr. Miguel del Rosario asked, there is this phenomenon of people somehow being able to simulate near-death experience-like experiences, you know, produced by stimulating the brain. Well, Mike wants to ask, is this actually simulated, or you know, could such experience actually kind of be bringing someone sort of to that spiritual dimension or closer to death's door or whatever? So, and I guess it ties into the whole fact that some people have claimed, well, you can reproduce, you know, ecstatic experiences or a sense of God's presence through, you know, the God helmet that someone once invented to kind of stimulate. So what's going on in those kinds of situations? Is it then a purely biochemical thing, or actually is it all part of the same thing as far as you're concerned?
The God helmet thing didn't really pan out very well. So that's a forgotten thing. And what happens is that somebody can, you know, put an electrode in your brain and you might have something that sounds like one part of a near-death experience, or somebody on a ketamine on a drug might report something that's similar. But I am not aware of anything that stimulates, for example, meeting dead relatives. I'm not familiar with that. I'm not familiar with anything that creates a life review. I'm not familiar with any artificial stimulant or interference that makes people think this is the most important thing that ever happened to me and it's absolutely real, and I'm going to live differently from now on. I don't know about those things, but I don't think they're there. But the other thing is even if you can simulate something, that doesn't mean there isn't a real something to be perceived. That is, I don't know, you can be in a flight simulator and it feels like you're flying and, you know, and so on. But it doesn't mean there aren't real airplanes that you can't get in and fly.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could come up with a million examples. Sometimes when you're hit in the head, you really do see stars. Okay, so you've simulated seeing stars, but there are real stars to be seen. So we have artificial reality now, don't we? We can fool our brains into doing all sorts of things. That there is an artificial reality doesn't mean there isn't a reality.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, coming back though to the kind of stimulated type, and there's been a lot of interest recently in psychedelic drugs. You know, there's been a bit of a renaissance of interest in that. In fact, funny story here. I was just on my way, actually. I was in America just recently myself on holiday with the family, and as we drove back to the airport, the taxi that we were in, I struck up an interesting conversation with the driver, who told me about amazing experiences he said he'd had on psychedelic drugs, psilocybin, I think, ayahuasca, I think that was it.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And he talked about it opened up my third eye. I had the most extraordinary experiences. I was like floating through the universe. I was having he said it convinced me that there is a spiritual dimension. And now this guy's not a Christian, but he said, you know, I could never be an atheist. This has convinced. Now, what's interesting is that's obviously a chemical thing happening to him. And I was kind of cautioning him, you know, this is the Christian, the conservative Christian in me coming out saying, look, well, you know, I agree that, you know, things like that could trigger spiritual experiences, but you need to be careful of what the source is of that, you know, not all things may necessarily lead in the right direction. But it was just an interesting conversation. And as I read your book on arriving back, I thought, I wonder what Dale makes of that particular way into these types of experiences. Do you think that that's, given that there's a lot of obviously literature on that sort of type of thing, psychedelics and so on. Do you think that that's, again, touching the same kind of spiritual dimension that you're open to for these other sorts of experiences?
So I deliberately avoided that in the book because this is such a controversial subject. But I would encourage Christians to keep an open mind. What's happening now is there's a lot of serious work going on, especially at Johns Hopkins University, with some of these drugs. And some people, after certain drugs, do report that their worldview has changed. And maybe drugs are affecting their brains in ways that allow them to areas of consciousness that they haven't seen before, or that allow their consciousness to go somewhere they haven't seen before. I think we're still in the preliminary stages of this, and we're going to have to wait and see. I mean, these are serious scientists who are, you know, measuring everything, and they're interviewing everybody, and they're doing it very carefully. And we need to see what's happening. I do know, however, this is not a fact that I'm happy with, but I have to acknowledge it. So back in the early 60s at Harvard Divinity School, when Timothy Leary was just starting up and LSD was just coming out, a bunch of seminary students were given a low dose of LSD before taking communion. I think it was Easter. Anyway, they were given, you know, a dose of something. And several of them, I don't remember the percentage, said it was the most meaningful experience that they had had. And then somebody followed this up 40-some years later, many of them still said it, that that communion episode did something to me that nothing else has, and I don't regard it as illusory. So I don't know what to make of this. I've never taken drugs at all.
Yeah.
I've never taken anything. Antihistamines, right? Yeah. That's about it. So, you know, my experiences are just spontaneous. I don't know. I did once write a book on George Harrison, the Beatle, and he did famously claim that he met God on LSD, right? Mm. He didn't encourage other people to take LSD, but as he looked back on his life, he said, well...
Yeah. And for the record, we are not encouraging anyone to do likewise.
No,
on this show, but we're acknowledging the fact that, again, as you say in the book, you know, people have experiences, and you know, that's the reality of it. Now, what conclusions you draw, I guess, you know, that's up for grabs. And as I say, I was keen not to. I didn't want to dismiss this man's experience, you know, in the taxi. I wanted to say, okay, you obviously had an amazing experience and it's obviously changed you, you know, in a significant way. But I didn't want to at the same time affirm that this is the only way to access God, if there is a God,
yes,
that there is, this is somehow the de facto way that you have to go through this psychedelic route, that there may in fact be downsides to trying to kind of control, in a sense, the religious experience.
There are downsides. That's why the people at Johns Hopkins are being very careful.
Well, look, we've ranged all over the place in what's been a fascinating show in so many ways, and you've been very kind with the amount of time you've given me today, Dale, to talk through the book. As I say, there's so much that you do cover, but it's such a huge area. There's lots that doesn't get covered as well, but maybe there'll be a round two at some point. But for now, I encourage people to go and check out the book. It's full of fascinating stories, obviously. And you do a great job, as I say, I think, in trying to come to terms with this, take it seriously, but kind of put a critical eye and a skeptical view on it, and ask, you know, what can we make of this as thinking, intelligent people who may be open, though, to the idea that there's a realm out there. So thank you very much for the book, Dale. And it was absolutely delightful to talk to you today.
Thank you very much, Justin. I appreciate it.
Well, I'd love to hear your responses to some of the stories that Dale has shared today and his thoughts on it. Perhaps you've got an interesting story you could tell us about. Unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to get in touch. You can also leave your comments alongside our social media. So find us over on Facebook, facebook.com/premierunbelievable. I'm on Twitter as @unbelievablejb. You can find more links and ways to get in touch with the show from our website, premierunbelievable.com. unbelievable.com. And thanks for those who've also, of course, been getting in touch about the recent events here in the UK. To Alyssa, who sent a lovely note to say, just wanted to drop a line and say, we, my household and many Americans, are so sorry to hear of the Queen's passing. She truly was a remarkable lady, and I'm so grateful for her presence in the world. When I heard the news, I reflected on an episode where N.T. Wright was sharing the story of the coronation Bible he received at the age of 5 or 6 during the Queen's coronation, it being his first Bible and helping ignite the spark of his enduring love for Scripture. And we love N.T., so grateful that happened. I thought, we just never know who we impact and what shape that'll take for the kingdom. I think about that going forward for your nation. Think about it for mine and in my own vocation as a mother and a mental health care provider. All that to say, I'm so thankful for her far-reaching influence coming through in unexpected ways. I'd also like to mention how grateful I am for such a beautiful homage to your leader on your most recent Unbelievable episode. To hear of any leadership figure being honoured for their service right now without a hint of cynicism, well, it's heavenly. You've done your leader proud and modelled, I think, a healthy posture of gratitude for wise leadership that we can all follow. So please know we grieve for your loss and we rejoice over your good fortune for having this dear lady at the helm. Peace be with you all at Premier. Thank you very much, Elisa. It's lovely to receive that and the other messages that have come through in the past week. In fact, I live not too far from Windsor Castle, and I was able with my wife Lucy to go over there earlier in the week to see some of the atmosphere and the people who are leaving memorials and well-wishing at the castle there. There's lots of flowers that have been laid at the gates of the castle at the top of the Long Mile. And yeah, it was really touching to see that and to be part of that. I even took the opportunity to just pop in to the parish church, which is literally in the shadow of the castle. It's only a stone's throw from it, to speak to the deputy church warden. This is Estlyn Davies. Now, St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle will become the final resting place of Queen Elizabeth II after the funeral's taken place at Westminster Abbey this Monday. But crowds have been flocking into Windsor to pay their respects, and the Windsor Parish Church of St. John the Baptist is where they've often been going in to sign the Book of Condolence, lighting a candle in memory of the late Queen. So, as I say, I spoke to Estlyn about the many visitors that they've been welcoming through their doors.
I think they've all been very reverent and glad to have the church open, and extremely pleased to be able to light a candle and also sign the condolence books. They're not just signing the names, they're writing reams about what they thought about the Queen. And the reading it is extremely touching.
Yes.
Because people are so grateful for all the years that she served us and with such dedication. But on Thursday evening, it was only announced at 6:30, they were just closing the church, as we normally do. It's always open from 10 till 6. And suddenly a crowd of people came.
Gosh.
And until 9 o'clock, we were open, and 400 candles were lit.
Goodness.
And 600 people actually came in.
Wow.
In that time. So we were up here really early on the Friday and Saturday and Sunday. And it was a continuous stream. They were queuing to light the candle. They were queuing all the way down the aisle, and then they were queuing back round to come and sign the books. We had 4 books out, and we kept running out of paper.
Gosh.
But everyone was... And then lastly, yesterday, there was one of our lay readers, Anne Casson, was here, and she did... sort of 5 minutes prayers on the hour from 1 to 2, and then we had a service here at 5 o'clock, not advertised at all. It was just a normal, we would have been evening prayer, but we didn't have that. And our rector Sally, she conducted a beautiful service. It just lasted about 1/4 hour. We were amazed. We counted 60 sitting in the pews, and there were loads of other people around coming in. But everyone was very reverent and quiet. There hasn't been a lot of noise. A lot of children have come in, and we've been able to say to them, you know, we're glad you're here, because when you're in the sixth form in school, you'll be having history lessons, and this will be history, and you'll be able to say, I was there.
Indeed. I mean, we're sitting just here outside the entrance to the church here on Monday this week. People are coming and going still, lighting candles. I mean, for you, what does this local parish church represent in terms of an opportunity, I suppose, for people to express something of their love for the Queen, but also, I suppose, to connect it with something bigger, something sacred?
Yes, I think so. And the way people have been coming in, their attitude, and saying to small children, shh, because we're coming into church. And it's been amazing, really. But I think this church has been here. I mean, we've just celebrated 200 years of this building.
Right.
There's been a church here since 1200, I believe.
Right.
And I think that it just allows people to express thoughts they have. They may not go to church these days, but they still have a knowledge that there is a greater being.
Mm. That was Eslyn Davies talking to me just outside the Windsor Parish Church of St John the Baptist about the influx of visitors they've seen there in recent days. Be interested in your thoughts on these historic occasions that are happening. As I say, very interesting article from Glenn Scrivener we've just put up this weekend. And that's really looking at the way that these national events, and especially this morning around the Queen, has sort of revealed the latent spirituality, the historic Christian roots of so much that formed the institution of the monarchy in the UK. It's a bit of a response as well to a recent letter from Humanists UK saying that there's been too much religiosity around the outpouring of mourning and so on around the Queen. So it's an interesting response to that as well. Well, we'll be returning to our usual format on Unbelievable soon, and we'll get to a lot of your feedback to recent weeks of programming as well. But for now, that's all we've time for. I hope you have a great week. Let me tell you what's coming up next time. Well, next week, we'll be bringing you the material from our recent Falling from Grace webinar on church abuse and leadership scandals. I was joined by Rachel Den Hollander, herself a victim of sexual abuse at the hands of Larry Nassar in the US gymnastics team. She was the first woman to publicly come forward and accuse him. That led to hundreds more coming forward and him actually being jailed. She's now an advocate for survivors of abuse, both in the secular and church world. Amiel Ewing is the former vice president of RZIM. She, of course, was caught up in the middle of that unfolding drama as posthumous revelations and allegations against Ravi Zacharias came out. She'll be telling us all about that. Mike Cosper, the producer and host of the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast, will be talking about Mark Driscoll and the implosion of Mars Hill Church and the lessons that have been learned from that. Diane Langberg is a trauma and abuse specialist. They all join me for this special panel with hundreds of Unbelievable listeners partnering with 31.8, the UK's leading independent Christian safeguarding charity. Really important subjects and really powerful moments in that event. Lots of great questions and responses. You'll be able to hear it, watch it next week on podcast, on video, on radio too, and all available from our website, premierunbelievable.com. Until then, have a good week.